Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Tonight we begin lesson 5 of our class, Toward a Meaningful Life, The Shadows, Dealing with Pain, Loss, and Suffering. Yum. How exciting. I think we all would like to skip it, but it is important. Which flavor do you take? Ah, okay.
I just planted a pomegranate.
Anyway, let's do a quick recap of last week's lesson. Last week's lesson, we discussed work. And we started out with the common understanding of work, which is common perspective as a means to survive, to make money, to receive. But to say that work is integral and part and parcel of a person's being, who they are, would not exactly be accurate in the common perception of work. The Torah, however, takes a radical approach and says that people are born to toil, and work is part of our core. It is who we are, and hence we are commanded to work. 6 days a week shall you work, and the seventh you shall rest. The way that the seventh Shabbat becomes holy is through 6 days of work. So in essence, we discussed how God created the world in such a way that we can partner with Him in creation. He bestowed kindness upon us. God, in essence, wants to be good, and He bestowed kindness upon us so that we can better appreciate our lives. When a person creates something, when a person looks at the fruit of his labor and says, "This is my creation," they feel good. It makes them feel accomplished. And in essence, that's how we partner with God in creation. This is achieved through toiling, through developing, through the sciences, through mining the resources of the universe. And in essence, just like a person never retires from life, if work is integral to the core of who you are, you also never retire. In essence, a person's work may change, right? A 20-year-old and a 60-year-old have different abilities, their levels of work and their ability to do, say, physical labor is different, but the need to continuously produce never ends. And on the contrary, we discussed how people who are older have more experience. Their ability to accomplish may actually be greater than those who are younger because of the vast knowledge that they have from a lifetime of work. Then we discussed how when a person works, they receive in order to give, the concept of charity. And in elevating our personal lives and the lives of those around us by giving to others. And engaging in work, we also discussed how that can be a unique challenge because there are a lot of things that challenge our daily ability to be, in essence, God requires of us to be spiritual. Yet at the same time, God tells us that at the core of your being, you must work, you must toil. So which one is it? Does God want us to work, or does God want us to be spiritual? Oh. And the answer is both. The answer is yes and yes.
And the work is spiritual. Right. They all have the spiritual aspect of it.
The way we do that, we discuss, is by when you work, you give your heart, your soul, and your very being goes into your work, right? Your mind, your entire being goes into your work. So in essence, you're giving of your life, your time. That's the most important thing that we have. Time. Right? Aristotle said, what's the greatest teacher that kills us all? Time. Right? Experience. So when we give our time to our vocation, in essence, we're giving our very lifeblood to our work. So the money we earn, in essence, is our life. And therefore, when we give it to someone else, you're giving of your own life to another person. So you're, in essence, uplifting your work, and you're helping another, and you're making the world into a more hospitable place. And finally, we discussed how it's important not to lose sight of the important objectives, because within a workplace, there are a lot of things that can drag you down. It can be an evil boss. It can be a difficult coworker. It can be simply the very nature of your work may be challenging to your moral and ethical values. Very common, specifically in white-collar vocations. If you're a banker, if you're a stock trader, if you're, a lot of these things, you come across serious moral challenges every single day.
Bank robber.
If you're a bank robber, that can pose a serious challenge to your moral values. Anyway, so we discussed how it's important to recognize every single day the challenges that our work gives us and the need to add a little prayer during the day, either in the beginning or middle of the day, to ensure that we remain focused on the real purpose of work, to partner with God and elevate ourselves and the world around us. That was last week. And now, ladies and gentlemen, I bring you to this week. Let's pop out the popcorn.
On a beautiful spring morning in 2001, 13-year-old Kobe Mandel and his friend Yosef Ishran decided to skip school and hike in the canyon near their home in Tekoa, Israel. They never returned. They were trapped in a cave and beaten to death with rocks by five Arab men. Kobe's parents were grief-stricken, but determined to transform the horror of Kobe's death into something positive. Having experienced firsthand the devastating intensity of loss, Sherry and Seth Mandel were resolved to help other Israelis who had lost family members to terrorism. Camp Kobe was created for children whose parents or siblings were murdered by terrorists. The camp provides a haven for children to bond with others who can hear their stories and understand their loss. It is a place to cry, to laugh, to be a child again, and to heal. Today, the Kobe Mandel Foundation serves over 600 children. A healing retreat for bereaved mothers and widows has also been added, allowing them to grieve, to bond, and to find new strength.
That's really the way of healing the world. Because that's what the Jews are called on, to do tikkun ha'olam. And I really feel that tikkun comes from a very deep place, and it comes from a place of pain.
Grief and suffering can break our spirit, demoralizing us and making us bitter. We can never explain away pain, but sometimes we can channel the power of pain into new growth.
Okay, so we begin tonight. Obviously, this is a lesson that is probably not, I'd say, the most comfortable topic to discuss. There's nobody in this room that has not experienced pain, suffering, and there's actually nobody in the world that has never experienced, that has not experienced it. So, just a quick overview of what we're going to discuss today. First and foremost, why is there so much pain and suffering? Suffering, in essence, it upsets us, but at the same time, the mere fact that it does upset us testifies to the fact that we believe in a fair and righteous God. Because if you didn't believe in a fair and righteous God, then why should pain and suffering upset you? Why is there pain and suffering? Why not? However, if you believe in a God that's fair and righteous, then we can never accept pain as natural. We can't accept it as something that a fair and righteous God would willingly bestow upon us. Specifically, last week we discussed the concept of God wanting to be good. Teva HaTov LaHeitev. God, in essence, wants good for us. So the question is, how do we escape the clutches of pain? They're very real and inevitable. Inevitable. It's just a fact of life. Just like you're born, just like everybody goes, and just like we pay taxes, we're going to have pain. And taxes also is a lot of pain. But nevertheless, so tonight we're not going to talk about why do bad things happen to good people. And I want to preempt, probably, inevitably, people are going to want to ask about the Holocaust. But tonight is not about the Holocaust. We're not going to discuss the Holocaust. The Holocaust, I believe, as a grandchild of survivors who grew up hearing the stories from my grandmother and my grandfather, I'd say a lot of what we're going to discuss tonight is probably not applicable to something as severe and as debilitating as the Holocaust. The Holocaust is on a grand scale. We're talking about individual pain and suffering.
I think it's really interesting that you just said. Usually the argument that people give against God is, with all the terrible things, how can there be a God that allows all this stuff, that allows bad things to happen? And you basically took that argument and turned it on its head and said, because those bad things happen and because we think we're bad, that proves that it's a righteous, a loving God.
Well, if you didn't believe in a righteous, loving God, then it wouldn't bother you.
I just think it's ingenious, that's all. I'm just making a comment.
I
never thought of it in those terms, because usually the argument is used to prove that the other, you know, the same circumstances used to prove the opposite.
That's
he said,
true.
But yeah.
Does that mean that atheists don't feel pain?
They do, but they can't. An atheist, in essence, cannot question pain.
But they feel when
they. Oh, yeah, no, nobody's going to argue that, yeah. Right, no, I agree. Every human is wired to feel pain. So natural, if a person doesn't feel pain, there's something wrong with them. They're unhealthy. Human beings are wired to believe, right. We're talking about questioning pain and suffering. The big question, why would a human being suffer? Now, what we're going to address tonight primarily is how to avoid becoming paralyzed by pain. Pain and suffering can be debilitating and can paralyze a human being and can prevent them from being human, in essence. So we're going to discuss that. We're also going to discuss how the Torah gives us, and this is an idea, it's a very powerful idea. The Torah gives us advice and enables us not just to survive pain, but to strive as well. As we come out of a painful experience, we will discuss how we can strive as a result thereof. And as the Jewish people know more than probably any other people, we've known more pain than any other people, but at the same time, arguably, we've flourished more than any other people.
We've been around longer.
That's true too, but the pain that we've experienced and the other side of it is that we've flourished more so. I mean, you look at the Nobel Peace Prizes, the amount of Nobel Peace Prizes, and what Nobel Prizes, not just peace.
Yeah.
Actually, probably not peace, although many more Jews probably should have gotten it. But Nobel Prizes in the medicine and sciences have a disproportionate amount of Jews, somewhere in the 25% range, whereas our population, as far as the world is concerned, is 0.02%. So obviously, we know about all this. And when you talk about pain, it's inevitable that you know, emotions come up. It's a very emotional topic. Now, there are different reactions to pain, right? When people go through a painful or difficult situation, they can, one, explain it. It happened because of X, Y, and Z. Two is minimize it. It's not so bad. Three is rationalize it. Four is become bitter and cynical. And five, the most probably the most difficult result of pain is that people sometimes use it to justify malicious behavior. They say, I went through pain, why shouldn't that person suffer as well? And it becomes an evil cycle. We see this specifically, we see this when people are molested as children. It becomes an evil cycle. They then perpetuate it onto others and things like that. But all of these are actually not good approaches. Because ultimately, we're going to float an idea that no explanation is ultimately sufficient. Trying to explain someone else's pain can be actually an abusive. It's vulgar. It's an abusive. It's something abusive to try to explain someone else's pain. The objective, ultimately, good evening, is how to cope and deal with the shadows of our lives. We're also going to discuss guidance, how to sensitively address others who are suffering. And there's an interesting story of somebody who went to a Rebbe, to a spiritual leader, and he cried to him and said, "Look, you know, I've gone through this difficult experience, that difficult experience." And the Rebbe looks at him and tells him, "Look, I have no answers for you, but I can cry with you. That I can do." And sometimes that's the only approach. So we're going to cover all these ideas I just mentioned in a nutshell. So let's start with what is pain. Let's start with the introduction, actually. More?
No one is immune to experiencing loss and suffering. At some point, all of us will go through challenging times. This lesson aims to address these shadows of our lives precisely as shadows. But shadows that are always enhanced by light. When there is a shadow, there is light. Even in the face of sorrow, there's hope.
I want you to do also text 1, page 122.
She weeps bitterly in the night, and her tears are on her cheeks. She has no comforter among all her lovers. All her friends have betrayed her. They have become her enemies.
So, this is from Lamentations. It's one of the books of the Torah, 24 books. We read it actually on Tisha B'Av. So what is pain? Pain is a time when we've all experienced it. Specifically when it's acute, there's nothing that can really comfort you. Even friends that try to comfort you sometimes can be seen as enemies. You don't want people near you, you just want to be left alone. How do we understand this feeling? So, when a person is in pain, or when you're in pain, the idea is not to question the pain. The idea is how to figure out methods to help it dissipate, how to help it grow away, to logically try to explain. Remember one of the five things that we said before, the first thing was to explain pain. To logically try to explain pain is grotesque. A person just had a debilitating loss, for instance. Say, you know, we just saw in the video, a person loses their child, 11-year-old, murdered. How are you going to sit and try to explain that to a parent? I understand you. I feel you. Anything you say just doesn't make sense. There's no way it's going to make sense. And trying to explain it is grotesque, in essence. You're trying to put into words something that is beyond human comprehension, beyond anything a human being can really sit down and grasp. So, perhaps in a setting like this, a detached setting, you know, in a class we're discussing it, we can explore what pain is. But we can't explore the reasons behind it. Rather, we can explore how to overcome and grow from pain. Biologically, pain is actually healthy. It means that your system is working well. If you have a cut, if you have a physical ailment, if you didn't feel pain, you wouldn't seek help. You wouldn't go to a doctor. So lack of pain, from a biological standpoint, is a serious problem. It means that a person is really something wrong with them. It's a siren. Pain is a warning sign. It tells a person, hey, go for help. If a person, and emotionally this is true as well, the same idea applies emotionally. When a person is feeling pain, that means something is in need of repair. If a person feels no pain emotionally, something terrible happens to a person, not a physical hurt on their body, but something emotionally happens to them, and they feel no pain, That's worse than any kind of pain. Emotional numbness is a worse, and sometimes people who really suffer a debilitating blow, for the first while they will not feel pain. They'll just be numb because it's just so overwhelming. And that's sometimes the body's reaction as well, right? When a person, people who have physical, terrible trauma will also not feel pain because the body simply cannot handle it. The brain just starts shutting down, because if a person would feel the pain, it would be the end of them. So, in essence, not feeling emotional pain is similar to not feeling physical pain. It's very dangerous. Indifference and numbness is worse than any kind of pain. And pain ultimately tells us that we're sensitive beings attuned to something that's wrong, to an imperfect world. Something wrong happened, and in essence, we're in pain. So healthy people feel pain. It's an awareness. And awareness is half the cure. If we're unaware that there's a problem, there's no way we can get cured. So the mere fact that we have pain, from a strictly biological point of view, quote unquote, is a good thing. If we were not to have pain, we would not be able to then try to heal the wounds that are ailing us. So now the question is, what do we do about the pain? As I mentioned in the opening, that pain can be debilitating. It can stop a person from functioning. So we understand that pain is necessary, because if a person didn't have pain, there would be something wrong. But now, at what point is it become too much and not allow a person to act as a healthy member of society? So there's a combination of many strategies when it comes to how to deal with pain. You can have silence, right? Just not say anything. Question. You can question the pain. Acceptance. At some point, you have to accept it. And then finally, move on, action. So we're going to start with the power of silence. This is a very intriguing idea. Historically, there's been no shortage of pain and suffering, specifically amongst our people. We discussed this before. So how did our greatest leaders respond when they were challenged with painful situations? How did God respond? So we can learn from the following examples profound wisdom of healthy approaches to pain. We're going to cover three scenarios: the Torah, the Talmud, and the Mishnah. And we're going to see from our greatest leaders about how they dealt with painful situations. So let's look at text number two, Tamra. Part two, the power of silence.
And Aaron's son, Nadab and Abihu, each took his pan, put fire in them, and placed incense upon it, and they brought forth before the Lord foreign fire, which he had not commanded them. And fire went forth from the throne of the Lord and consumed them, and they died before the Lord, and Aaron was silent.
So this is from the Torah, Leviticus. Now let's go to the Mishnah. To be or not to be? Number 2b.
When Moses went up on high to receive the Torah, God said to him, in the future there will be a man named Akiva, the son of Joseph, who will expound myths of laws from every stroke of the letters. In the Torah, Moses said to God, you have shown me his accomplishments in Torah, and now show me his reward. God said, turn and look behind you. Moses turned and saw them weighing Rabbi Akiva's butcher's flesh in the meat market. Moses said before God, is this Torah and is this its reward? God said to Moses, silence, so it arose in my thought.
Interesting, huh?
I don't exactly get it.
A little disturbing. We're going to talk about it in a second. Let's go to...
Did they really weigh?
Yeah. The Romans.
Did they weigh him and bury him, or did they...
The Romans?
Yeah.
in his flesh.
Yeah, no, I
don't know if they saw. I don't know. I think this is more of a euphemism, but it's not too far from the truth.
Were they alive at the same time, or was Moses seeing the future?
He was seeing the future. The background
was similar to Jesus, so they treated him.
Who? The Romans?
Yeah.
A little different problem. Yeah. A little discussion.
Is that they could see the future?
Who, Moses? He was a prophet.
No. God saw the future, and that's what we're saying here.
We're saying is Moses discussed the future with God.
So that was established the future.
I don't know if they were establishing that when it happened. He was saying this is going to happen.
Remember this point we talked about.
Okay.
What?
I know something's stirring in your
mind.
This is a whole different discussion. It's not in this class, but
sorry, that was
I'm just setting a foundation for a future discussion.
Okay, so let's go to 2C.
Well, wait a minute. What does this mean?
What it means is
silence. So it arose in my.
That's what I'm going to talk about in a second. I'm going to talk about the concept of silence. Let's just go to the last one because we'll see this idea again. Three times from the Torah, from the Mishnah, from the Talmud. We're going to show how silence. Yeah.
The daughter came peered through the window and saw the beauty of Rabbi Ishmael, the high priest. She sent a message to her father, asking him to grant her a single request. The king responded to her, "My daughter, anything you wish shall be granted, except if you ask me to spare the lives of Rabbi Ishmael and his colleagues." She replied to him, "If so, I ask of you to skin my face so that I can gaze at it instead of gazing at my own." When they reached the place on his forehead where he wore his tefillin, Rabbi Ishmael screamed aloud and bitter scream. The heavens and earth trembled. He screamed a second time, and the throne of God trembled. The angel said before God, "Should a righteous person such as this, whom you showed all the treasures of the upper world and all the secrets of the lower world, die such a grotesque death by such a wicked man? Is this Torah and is this its reward?" A heavenly voice called out, "If I hear another sound, I will turn the entire world into nothingness." When Rabbi Ishmael heard this, he was silent.
So all of these three examples we just discussed are obviously examples of unspeakable horror. Correct? Anybody disagree? Mm-hmm. I think everybody would agree that these are horrific situations. And every single one, a demand for explanation. There's a demand, right? They turned to God and said, "What's going on here?" And how is silence the answer to pain? God says silence, right? God says that if I hear one more word, I'm going to turn the world into nothingness. God says that silence. God tells, what was the first one? And it says that Aaron was silent. So what is that all about? Silence. Is it? How could God demand silence when there's such pain and suffering?
Funny, God, in the third one, God sounds like a parent. If I heard one more word out of you, I'm turning this car around.
It's pretty much, yeah. Yeah. And the answer is that, in essence, God, silence is not avoidance or refusal to answer. It's not what's happening here. What's happening here is that the only option when pain and suffering is so intense is silence, right? A bleeding heart cannot be comforted or consoled by the most brilliant mind. The person is suffering terribly, Einstein is not going to be able. Einstein can try to come up with every theory in the world, but it's not going to help because this person is in pain.
No.
So attempt, huh?
No, no, sorry.
And attempting to do so, in essence, would be cruel and insensitive. So in these situations, God just said, "Look, now is the time for silence. I'm not going to play lip service and try to explain what's going on, because that's only going to create chaos. It's going to create nothingness. God is saying, I'll turn the world into nothingness. It's going to create a situation of total chaos. Because nothing can appear the sheer magnitude of the raw suffering that the people are experiencing in situations like this. So, in essence, silence is saying, I may not be able to console you with words, but I can cry with you. Like that Rebbe said before. I can be here, I can just cry. But words will not work. And ultimately, silence is imperative, because there's no explanation within the sphere of human intelligence for suffering. There just is not, doesn't exist. So these three instances were powerful examples of silence being the antidote to a terribly difficult situation. I'll be right back. I want to see what's happening over there. It's very hard for me to concentrate.
It plays out when you're seeing Shiva.
Oh, sorry, but God said to Moses, silence, so it arose in my thought. What does that mean?
I don't get exactly what it means.
Silence, you don't say anything.
But it arose in my thought.
Yeah. Anything that you think.
Well, is it the incident that arose in God's thought that caused this?
The cause what?
So is it completely irrelevant, but in two of these three stories, the people that are going through suffering already know firsthand there's actually a God. They've been exposed to it. They're refutable. I mean, he says here, you know, in Aaron's case, he's most of his brother. He left it up in there.
He didn't ask it that like that. When he was put into a situation like that, he said, you know. The point is the silence. We're not talking about their particular suffering, and every person does suffer or experience pain on a different level. We're talking about the fact that these are terribly horrible situations, and when questioned, the response was silence. And the lesson to be learned is that where the initial response to acute pain and suffering cannot be explanation, cannot be trying to rationalize it or anything else, it has to be silence.
Yeah. I think it's interesting that this concept plays out in tradition. And when someone's sitting Shiva, my understanding is you don't approach them, you wait for them to approach you. You don't want to have a conversation with them. They just may not feel like talking. So you allow them to silence until they're ready for the next stage and to not be silent. So I
that's good.
Makes sense.
Yeah.
As far as I didn't understand, this is someone shut up.
Silence is the initial thing we're going to work into other things that as we move ahead. Anyway, let's look at text 3. And this is from Rabbi Yosef ben Avram Gikatila from 1247. He was a Spanish Kabbalist and Talmudist. Text 3.
Whenever the words "it arose in my thought" are used, it indicates that the proper response is silence, because the gates of human understanding are closed to this particular matter. It is concealed and sealed in this eternal chamber that no human can access. This is the chamber of deep thought, which is called God's infinite will. Thus, restrain your mouth from speaking. Your question is not in a place where you can comprehend anything. Thus, silence. Why? For so it arose in my thought, it is a place to which you cannot ascend. Indeed, how can a finite being accept a matter that is infinite? In this regard, Scripture says, your thoughts are very deep. The same is true with regard to the wicked prospering and the righteous suffering. Silence, for so it arose in my thought. This is alluded to in the above psalm. How great are your works, O Lord? Your thoughts are very deep. A boorish man does not know, neither does a fool understand this. When the wicked flourish like grass, and all perpetrators of evil blossom, why don't we understand? Because you are on high forever, as if to say, this matter is in your lofty thoughts. No one can access this matter.
So sometimes there's great profundity and not being profound. You know, we get jokes, we get ideas, we get concepts, but we don't get, quote unquote, pain and suffering. Logic ultimately cannot access this. And it's an awesome thing. Sometimes it's beyond the human mind to grasp. It's off when a person experiences or sees another person experiencing pain and suffering. It's just so, it's an awesome thing. I don't mean awesome as our kids use awesome.
No.
I mean awesome as it's awesome. Yeah, awestruck. Exactly. Text 4. Let's go to text 4. This is from Job. As we all know, a classical example of pain and suffering inevitably leads us to the book of Job. A whole book that talks about a person who experienced all types of difficulties in life. However, there's also a lot to be learned from the give and take, dialogue that Job has with God. So let's look at text 4. Who's
then,
there?
Then the Lord answered Job from the temple and said, who is this who gives dark counsel using words without knowledge? How gird your loins like a man, and I will ask you, and you tell me. Where were you when I founded the earth? Tell me if you have the knowledge. On what were its sockets sunk, or who laid these cornerstones? And who shut out the sea with doors when it broke forth and issued out of the womb? In all your days, did you command the morning? Did you tell the dawn its place? Have the gates of death been revealed to you? And do you see the gates of the shadow of death? Do you understand everything until the breath from the earth? Tell if you know it all. Which is the way to where the life dwells? And as for darkness, where is its place? Can you tie the chain of the
Pleiades,
or loose the trap of Orion? Do you know the ordinances of heaven? Can you place this dominion upon the earth? Who prepares the raven his prey and his young cry out of God as they wander for lack of food? Job answered the Lord and said, behold, I am of small account. What shall I answer you? I put my hand to my mouth.
So Job asks, turns to God, right? Turns to God. And what was Job's question to God?
Why me?
Exactly. Why me? Number one. Number two. Why all the pain and suffering? That was Job's question to God. Did God answer his question?
No, he just basically
he just did it.
He
did.
So you wouldn't comprehend the answer.
God absolutely did not answer his question, but he gave him an answer that is in tune with what we're discussing now. In other words, God in essence told him the following. God did not try to answer Job's question and rationalize his pain. God didn't tell Job, hey, the reason why I chose you is because you did X, Y, and Z. Or the reason why you're going through pain and suffering is because you did this and this and this. Or because your father did or your kids did. Or he didn't try to rationalize it. God instead was trying to impress upon Job and recognize the unfathomable truths of a higher reality. That's what he was doing. God in essence is telling Job, you ask why is there death, but you don't ask me why there's life. They're equally perplexing. You ask why is there destruction, you didn't ask me why there's creation. Equally perplexing. You ask why is there pain, you didn't ask me why is there joy. Is joy any less awe-inspiring than pain? You ask why there's an end. How about asking me why there's a beginning? So in essence, Job was being told that humans have a tendency to focus and ask questions and demand explanations when things are not going their way. When everything is fine and dandy, we don't turn to God to say, hey, why is everything so cool? Why am I so happy? You know? We just, you know, we kind of try to stay silent and keep under the radar. We try not to rock the boat, you know? So the truth is that death is intertwined with life, destruction is intertwined with creation, pain is intertwined with joy, and the end is intertwined with the beginning. They all work together. And in reality, we don't understand any of these mysteries of the world. We don't understand pain any more than we don't understand joy. And after God gave Job this explanation, he responded in the affirmative. He said, you know what? You're right. And he said, I don't know the mysteries of the world. I'm silenced. So, in essence, God did answer him. Not in a direct way to his question, but gave him a consoling response that enabled him to heal and move on. So in reality, we don't understand all the mysteries of the world. And Job, in essence, says, look, I stand in awe. You're right. It's an awesome thing. And silence comes from the depth of faith and acceptance of reality beyond our own. That's where it comes from. Silence, in essence, it's a humility. It has a mysterious healing power. And once one has acknowledged the fierce and brutal power of suffering and pain, and realizes that this incredible pain and suffering has not destroyed me, I'm still alive, I'm still around, then, in a strange way, it makes someone stronger. We all know people who have gone through extreme pain and suffering. And some of these people have this strange light about them, strange countenance of having steered absolute horror in the face, have been able to survive, and sometimes even grow as a result thereof. We all know these people. Some of them are some of the strongest people around. So, now we're going to go to section 3, Paradox of Faith. And the first question for discussion is, does this mean that we should not question pain and suffering? That we should just be completely silent and passive? Is there anything that we can do or should do in response to suffering? So let's get a consensus here. Does that mean that we shouldn't, that's it, silence? That means we should just accept it and move on?
It was at the beginning in the movie that you showed,
No, it doesn't mean we can't
search.
Of that,
you
that
have to turn it into something
action,
positive.
Right.
Action.
So, but do we accept pain?
I do. I accept it as part of life.
Accept, it depends how you mean accept. I mean,
no, as we say, okay, look, this is it. God, let's move on.
Yes. Yeah.
Accepted it, but I've always wanted to end.
Well,
they ask the question about why the perpetrators and the. I've seen so many rewarded who have done so much bad. That's always something I accept that that's the world now, but I never. I would like an answer. I accept there's no answer, but.
I don't think we accept it in the sense that we do
well,
nothing
I
about
think
it.
People really get rewarded. When I see that, it bothers me. I like justice. I like to see things balanced out. I don't understand why so many do who are so sort of evil tend to do, get prosper, and
yeah.
Don't seem too bothered by it. And those who have the wealth, I would say the same thing. I don't understand the paradox. So I know there's plenty of people that are bad and feel go through pain too, but there's also a lot of people that are pretty darn.
Right. So what we're saying here is that silence. Right, but the idea, this is another strong idea that we're going to work with now, is that silence should not be confused with acceptance.
Yeah.
Just because God tells us to be silent does not mean, just because the reason why we have to be silent is because there's really nothing we can say, does not mean that we have to accept it.
Yeah, otherwise there would be no one would invent a medicine.
Exactly. And on the contrary, we challenge God. We're going to read soon two texts from our greatest leaders, Moses and Abraham. They openly challenged God when they felt it was injustice. They felt that pain and suffering was, when they saw pain and suffering, they challenged God. They said, what's going on here? So we may be silent, but we don't accept. And the way that we ultimately, we may be silent, we don't accept, but the most important thing is action. Action ultimately enables us, first of all, to alleviate the pain of others, but equally important when we go through pain, a way that you can help alleviate your own pain is by moving to action. We're going to discuss a little more about what kind of action particularly we're discussing. But let's first go to the concept of challenging God, of not accepting pain. Although we may be silenced, we don't accept. Let's see Abraham, who challenged God when he saw injustice. Let's look at text 5:8.
And Abraham approached and said, will you destroy the righteous with the wicked? Perhaps there are 50 righteous people in the midst of the city. Will you destroy and not forgive the city for the sake of the 50 righteous people who are in its midst? Far be it from you to do a thing such as this, to put to death the righteous with the wicked, so that the righteous should be like the wicked. Far be it from you. Will the judge of the entire earth not perform justice?
So this is from Sodom and Gomorrah.
Yeah.
People who are obviously wicked, yet Abraham still stepped in and uses some pretty powerful words. Says, how could you do such a thing? You're the judge of the entire world, you will not perform justice. So Abraham challenges God. So we see, although we may be silent, we don't accept. The same thing happened with Moses in Exodus. Let's look at text 5b. Page 130.
Oh, yeah, nice. So Moses returned to the Lord and said, O Lord, why have you harmed this people? Why have you sent me? Since I have come to Pharaoh to speak in your name, he has harmed this people, and you have not saved the people.
So how do we resolve this paradox? So on one hand, we are commanded to be silent. On the other hand, we're commanded to challenge. Which one is it? The answer is that faith ultimately requires both. The same God that's beyond comprehension also gave us feelings. The same God that we cannot fathom his ways, as we saw in the book of Job, also makes us sensitive, also instilled and created us with pain. So these two things have to work in tandem. So on one hand, we have to realize that pain and suffering is beyond our comprehension. On the other hand, we are required to not remain passive. Faith demands that when we see people in need, we have to intercede on their behalf. It would be sacrilegious to accept with blind faith pain and suffering and say, look, the reason why these people are suffering is because they obviously did something to deserve it. It's because God wanted it. You see that sometimes, right? Where was it? The recent article in the paper. It was some in Haiti, right? Some minister got up and said, they deserved it or something. That's insane.
About 9/11 here.
Yeah, that's absolute insanity. But some guy said that. One of these evangelical ministers. So in essence, that's sacrilegious. We don't have to comprehend God's ways. And we don't have to explain God's ways, but we definitely do not have to accept it. And when something happens, when people are in pain or suffering, we have a responsibility to roll up our sleeves and try to alleviate that pain. So in summary, we question and challenge God and demand that He do away with pain and suffering. We realize that only God knows why pain and suffering ultimately exist. So these two things work in tandem from a faith-based application to pain and suffering. So now let's go to section 4. So now that we know that we discussed A, why there is pain, the natural response, it's healthy. It's a natural response to extreme situations. And then we discuss what the initial response to pain has to be. Right? It has to be silence. It cannot be any of the things that we mentioned when we first started this evening, right? There are many different ways to address pain. For instance, you can try to explain it, you can try to minimize it, rationalize it, you can become bitter and cynical, you can use pain to justify malicious behavior. We're saying no. You have to be silent. You can't try to explain pain and suffering. Now the fourth part is, so, okay, we know why we have pain. We know that we can't justify it, but is pain and suffering just a useless reality? Or is there something greater that can come as a result of it? Is there something that can come, something positive? Is it just a reality? We move on, or maybe we can use it as a catalyst for growth. So let's go to section 4.
Now Job raised his voice and said, if only the day in which I was born were lost. May thick darkness snatch that night. It shall not rejoice among the days of the year. May it not come among the count of the month. Behold, that night shall be lonely. No joyful singing shall come therein. May the stars of its evening be darkened. It shall hope for light, but have not. Neither shall it see the rays of dawn. For he did not shut the doors of my mother's womb to hide misery from my eyes. Why did I not die from the womb? Why did I not fire as I came out of the belly? For now I would be lying tranquilly. I would sleep, then it would be restful for me. But why was I not like a hidden stillborn child, like infants who did not see the light? Why does he give light to the sufferer and light to those of bitter spirit, to those who crave death, but it is not there? Who seek it more eagerly than hidden treasures.
So Job's response to this incredible pain is actually very human. A lot of people, when they go through pain, their response is not wanting to wake up. Just it can be so debilitating that the sufferer just doesn't want to wake up. As we see Gurudev was saying, I wish I was never born. I wish I didn't exist. Why do I have to go through all this? It's a natural response. But then, at some point, every human being that goes through pain, one morning, even for maybe a few moments, the sun shines. And slowly a person starts healing. The warm glow warms up a person, if even only for a moment. The pain may come crashing down again, but something starts. And for each person, there's a turning point. A turning point when he or she decides that the difficult process must begin of growing beyond the pain. Now, this generally is easier when you realize and you have awareness of your soul and of a divine purpose. Because without divine purpose, suffering is ultimately random, as I mentioned earlier. The only time we have a problem with suffering is if we believe in a righteous, good God. So we cannot explain suffering, but faith ultimately gives us strength to cope with it. We know first and foremost that we're never alone. God is always with us. Even in the most difficult situations, God ultimately cries and goes through these situations with us. Look at text 7a. Whose turn? Tamar.
Rabbi Yanai.
Yanai
said, just like conjoined twins, if one of them feels pain in the head, the other feels it too. Likewise, God says, I am with him in distress. God said to Moses, don't you realize that I am in pain just as the Jewish people are in pain? Note the place from which I talk to you from the form, as if to say, I am a partner in their pain.
So this is in regards to now personal suffering, because 7b, next text.
Whenever the Jewish people are enslaved, the godly presence is, so to speak, enslaved with them. Whenever they have pain, he has pain. We only know that the godly presence suffers with the suffering of the masses. How do we know that God is present when the individuals suffer as well? The verse therefore says, I am in distress with him.
So, while we never forget loss or pain and suffering, God ultimately gives us the strength to overcome it. The very same God that, in essence, created us in such a way that we experience pain and suffering, and created us in such a way that the pain and suffering can be acute, also instills within us the ability to overcome pain and suffering. Right? God never throws at us something that we cannot overcome. That would be unethical, immoral. It may seem very difficult. It may seem like a very difficult path to carry. But ultimately, if God throws something at us, he also gives us the ability to overcome it. Now, man is more than just a body. Right? Our first lesson is all about the spiritual identity, the spiritual DNA of a human being. So if our only component was our body, then pain would be ultimately something that can destroy a person. If you're a physical entity only, physical pain will destroy you. End the story. But because we have a very strong spiritual dimension, so faith tells us that we have the ability to overcome. Because pain does not become our life, it's only a component of life. There's something beyond it. Pain does not define us. We are not pain. It's a function of our lives. So the next important thing to do is to find a way to grow as a result of a painful experience. Let's look at text 8.
Those who sow in tears will reap with song. He will go along weeping. He will come back with song, carrying his sheaves.
So again, it's important to remember that we're not suggesting pain is ever good. It's not. We don't accept it. But if we are challenged with the reality of pain, the question is, what do we do with it? And the answer is that we look at all of life's events as part of our life's mission, right? The joy, the birth, the life, and also the opposite thereof is also part of life. And it becomes part of our mission. Remember we discussed the mission statement? It's part of our mission. And after we acknowledge the sacred space of pain with humble silence, we address suffering and look for ways to grow from the experience. To do this, ultimately, we have to frame pain. We have to consider exactly what it is. You know, there's an interesting story told about a great Hasidic master. His name was Rabbi Zusha of Anapoli. Came from the town of Anapoli. He was a disciple of the Magid of Mizrich, who was a disciple of the Baal Shem Tov. So we're talking about 250 years ago. And Rabbi Zusha went through every life's difficulty you can think of. He experienced it. He was dirt poor, his family, his kids, just everything was a disaster. And once another disciple of the Magid was complaining about his problems. So the Magid, Rabbi Dovber of Mizrich, tells this disciple, why don't you go to Reb Zusha and ask him how he deals with his problems? It'll help you alleviate your problems. So he goes to Reb Zusha, he knocks on his door, and he starts telling him, look, you know, I was by our master, our teacher, and I was telling him my problems. And he looked at me and he said, you know, go to Reb Zusha, ask him how he deals with his problems. Reb Zusha looks at him and starts scratching his head. And he's perplexed. He goes, why would he send you to me? He goes, what could I teach you about difficulties in life? Why would he send you to me? You see, he put it all in perspective. Everybody knew that he was going through terrible difficulties, but to him, he was like, you know, he was a jovial person and just dealt with every issue and moved on. And when the student saw that, he understood. It's not about dealing with it or getting engulfed in it and then figuring out how to handle it. It's about moving beyond it. So, let's give an example. Say, sometimes we're lucky to clearly see the relationship between pain and growth. For instance, a woman giving birth. Would any woman ever say it's a wonderful experience? The pain? No. But every woman says it is a wonderful experience, right? Giving birth. It's a new life. So there we see a clear corollary that the pain leads to something that is evident to all is a good thing. So in most instances, however, this is not the case. But the idea is to be able to transform tears into something that spawns growth. So first of all, how do we make pain a catalyst for growth? Anybody? Share with us ideas on how to make pain a catalyst for growth?
We open a Kobe Mandel camp.
Open a Kobe Mandel camp, okay. But like we mentioned a few moments ago, when everything is fine and good, people generally don't ask questions, right? God turned to Job and said, you didn't ask me how come there's joy in your life when you had it. Because we take life, when everything is going fine and dandy, we often take life for granted. It's just the nature of a human being. What happens when suddenly we have a traumatic experience, it takes us to the edge of life. That's what it does. It kind of jolts us. And in a certain way, darkness gives us a better appreciation of light. Right? When everything is fine and dandy, you don't appreciate life. When you go through a difficult experience, you look and you say, hey, I'm so lucky. When a person survives a terrible medical scare, they look at life with a newfound appreciation. Now, is it good that they went through the terrible experience? Absolutely not. Do we question why does a person have to suffer? Yes. But can we not to deny the fact that now the person has found so much more meaning in life and recognizes how every moment is so much more precious? Can we not deny the fact that when a person goes through a terrible medical experience and they survive, they will then cherish the time that they spend with their wives and their kids and their friends and their family so much more?
Mm-hmm.
That's also true. They will do that. It's inevitable.
I've heard people, when something bad happens to them, they no longer take for granted the blessing.
Exactly. You
say, oh my gosh, you had it so good.
You start appreciating everything. So in essence, pain can be an opportunity for self-examination. Again, and I have to stress this, that doesn't mean that pain is good. This is just how we deal with a painful experience. Huh?
You're taking a physical thing, using a physical pain, and you're trying to spread it out over what these stories are talking about. There's really not a relationship there.
Between what and what?
Between the physical pain and Rabbi Akiva and God saying, be silent. It had nothing to do with the physical pain.
Rabbi Akiva?
He wasn't dying from cancer or dying from something else. He was dying because the Jews and the Romans were killing him.
But the pain is not
pain.
I know the pain isn't, but he's talking about pain, like you get cancer and then you survive it and you say, oh,
it's
I'm better
still
for
pain.
It. Well, in that case, you're absolutely right. There's no connection.
But no, but you're, Mort, what you're saying is, again, and that's why I
you cannot take a physical ailment and spread it out to the whole scene.
There's a clear difference, you're right.
Yes.
One is,
you keep doing it.
One is perpetrated by evil people, which is a different question altogether.
Well, I don't know if it's evil people or not.
Right, the Romans, they killed Rabbi Akiva. It was a human condition that created the pain. And one is a natural condition that created the pain.
Yes.
Right? Now, when we're dealing with a human condition that created the pain, there's another dimension. And that is, how can God allow the human to torture another human and say, let that human who is the torturer prosper? That's a different question. That has nothing to do with what we're discussing. That's a separate issue altogether.
It's like there's three issues then. And I didn't want to combine the third issue that you just brought in. But to say that you appreciate life now that you get over the illness and you understand all the blessings, that's wonderful. And that's something we could all relate to. I don't know how God's involved in that, or I don't know how God's not involved. But when you take the first three stories that we opened up, at least the second and third, I just don't know how you begin to explain those.
Okay, we can drop the medical thing, but let me just ask you a question. The case that we brought up about a woman who lost her 11-year-old child because of some bloodthirsty Arabs in Israel, right? It's a terrible thing.
Sure.
The pain that she suffered is debilitating. Would it be any different if her 11-year-old child died from leukemia?
What do you think?
I think the approach would be identical. How to deal with the pain. How we have to deal with the pain. How we have to help her deal with the pain. How she has to help herself grow as a result thereof. The point is how you deal with a painful situation, not how the pain came about. How the pain came about, I think, is really secondary and not as important as what we're discussing, which is how to deal with a painful situation, how to help people deal with a painful situation. Now, whether she opened the camp for leukemia survivors or for kids who are survivors of terrorist situations, they're both identical. Because what she's doing is she's using her pain to try to do something good.
Completely agree with you. I have no qualms with that. What I have a qualm with is what we opened up with.
Which is? With Abraham?
So it arose in God says to Moses, silence of it arose in my thought. It arose in God's thought to do this to Rabbi Akiva.
Ah, so that's a separate question.
That's a question that can't be answered, but this is a loving, worshipful, warm, friendly God.
But that, see, that's why I...
How do you understand the God?
And that's why I specifically started the class saying that we're not going to touch that.
We'll talk about that after. Every aspect of pain except the essential.
That's, no, no, but I
have a question for you.
Mort, we can discuss that. We'll discuss it after the class.
There's a merciful God and there's a judgmental. There's many aspects of God. To me, are we culturally fantasized this merciful, loving, lost God, but I know that there's a God who's merciful and a God who's judgmental.
But Mort, your question is 100% valid. It is a very valid question. And it's a question actually that has been asked for generations, and it's a question that has been the topic of previous classes. But the topic of this class, you always raise it. But the topic of this class is specifically how to deal with pain and suffering personally or helping other people. How it came about is a side issue, and it's a valid one. I'm not saying it's 100% valid. We can discuss it, but that's not part of this class. Fair enough?
You made it part of the class by having that.
It was part of the text. They threw it in.
Example.
If I was writing the text, I'd cut it out.
This was such an egregious example.
What happened? Tamara, something. What?
I believe.
You have to leave? Something that we said?
Such an egregious.
Uh-huh. No, I understand what you're saying. We could have cut out that piece of text, but it is what it is.
I think you're focusing on the specifics of the example instead of seeing how the example relates to the topic of the next class.
That example hit you.
What?
How does that example hit you?
It hits me the same way it hits you, but that's a different point.
You can get by.
What?
And you can get by.
For the purpose of the course, yeah. I mean, that's a separate thing. It's a valid question. It's just not
okay,
a
let's
question at hand.
So let's look at how pain can be an opportunity for self-examination. Let's look, what was the last one we read?
We read not 8, so we're on 9A.
So let's do 9A and 9B.
And I saw that there is an advantage to wisdom over folly, as the advantage of light over darkness.
So here we clearly see how. Continue. 9B will explain that.
Rabbi Chaya began to expound and said, "I have examined the words of King Solomon in different places and observed his great wisdom. This verse needs examination. Why did he say, 'I saw'? Or 'I saw'? Don't all people know and see this? Even those who are ignorant or unwise know that there is an advantage to wisdom over folly, as the advantage of light over darkness. Yet he praises himself and says, 'I saw.' We learn that it means this: 'I saw that there is an advantage to wisdom through folly,' meaning wisdom excels through presence of actual folly. For were there no folly in the world, wisdom and its matters would not be known. We learn that one who studies wisdom must also study a little folly and know it. For in this way, wisdom excels just as light excels through the presence of darkness. Were there no darkness, light would not be made known, and the world would not benefit from it."
Yes. If there is no misery, you don't enjoy happiness as much.
Right. Again, this is important to realize. This doesn't. We don't say misery is good. If we experience misery, the question is how to deal with it, and we have to look at ways to grow as a result. Now we're going to talk about how pain actually allows us or gives us an opportunity to access deeper resources of inner strength. Let's look at text 10. Mort, I think it's your turn again.
Rabbi Hanan said, "Why are the Jewish people compared to an olive? Because the olive does not release its oil unless crushed.
So we see that suffering can bring forth unrevealed levels of inner strength. Some people argue the reason why the Jewish people are so resourceful, and we do represent 25% of Nobel Prize winners, is simply because of exactly, it's a necessity. We've been crushed and tortured so much that as a result we've just become very, we're able to stay a little ahead of the curve, as they say, a little ahead of the game.
But without digressing too much, because I know the other point I made was really wasn't that relevant in my discussion, that's always been what I think of questions about why perpetrators and evil, etc., don't often get the suffering because of what they're saying here. You know, if you're crushed, the oil comes out, and the same with the perpetrator. The people who I've seen go down or quote, get theirs in life, there is a change of heart. They tend to become better people, usually, not always.
Doesn't,
yeah, not because I claim like I have some right to understand God. Who am I to understand God? I mean, we learned before that God almost in many ways cannot be understood. And many, you know, like the rabbis have said, sometimes in pain, we can't always explain the why, but we can't even ask the question. We have to just accept that it exists. But it is perplexing that there's this tool that could be used to better everything on earth. And it's a strange paradox that if anything, it's almost as if
Yeah.
Well, if you inflict pain and suffering on perpetrators, on bad people, they tend to become better. I mean, you know, again, go to any law firm and watch, you know, mean senior partner X, who's always grilling people and not, you know, really searching for the truth and everything, go through cancer. I've seen it twice now. There's a change of heart. They become better people. So, you know, because it's such a powerful tool and such a quick and, provocative
and
quick and substantive impact. I just don't understand
what
you
guys.
Yeah, Scrooge.
And it's something we don't understand.
It's a fair question.
It's a fair question and we don't understand it.
So when they're making this point about the light and the darkness, and you're saying, you know, they realize true happiness is rather than pain, you kind of trigger that thought. That's probably what
No, it's good. Look, these are very valid questions. It's very similar to the question Mort asked.
Yeah.
You know, it's in a similar vein, and these are very valid questions. And we can sit all night. I'll bring out a good bottle of scotch, and then we'll wake it. And then when dawn breaks, right? We may not have the answer, but we definitely will have finished the whole bottle.
Yeah.
As they say, sometimes the answer is on the bottle. It's in the bottom of a bottle. It may not be this one. It may be the next one, or the one after that. But it's at the bottom of some bottle. Anyway, so the idea is we don't ask why pain is, but we ask what we can do about it. There's a story of the former chief rabbi of Israel, Rabbi Israel Meir Lau, who came. He was in an audience with the Rebbe of blessed memory right after the Yom Kippur War, 1973. And it was a very terrible time for the Israelis. I mean, their invincibility had just been punctured terribly. They in 1967, the Six-Day War, they managed to obliterate literally six at four Arab armies. And suddenly, 5 years later, the whole country almost fell. They came this close to losing that war. They turned it around miraculously and were able. So the spirit had been terribly punctured. So the Rebbe asked him, you know, what are people feeling like? What's the mood in Israel? So he answered. He said, you know, they're all asking, what are we going to do? No, what's going to be? What's going to be? He said, all the Jews are saying, what's going to be? You know, we had just been... So the Rebbe, you know, got very serious and told him, Jews don't ask what's going to be. We ask, what are we going to do? There's a fundamental difference between those two things. What's going to be, in essence, is, you know, it's a defenseless victim. What's going to be? Confidence leader is, what are we going to do? Right? No soldier ever wants to be caught behind a platoon leader that's saying what's going to be. You don't want to be caught behind them. On the other hand, a guy who's saying, what are we going to do? Also a question, but you know what? It's a lot different. So, the same is true with pain and suffering. We don't ask what's going to be, we ask what are we going to do. The fact that it happened, it happened. Now what are we going to do about it? So, how do we do this? How do we figure out what we're going to do? So first and foremost, it takes a realigning of perspective. It takes a serious commitment. And these things never happen overnight. It takes discipline, study, reflection, meditation, prayer, all these things help. Realigning your frame of mind so you can take pain and suffering and do something. Not just let it weigh you down. And it takes an introduction of a higher value system. Introducing this higher value system into our lives. It's a different way of thought. And ultimately, belief in a higher power and soul searching allows us to cope with suffering. By binding ourselves with our immortal and eternal selves, we can overcome and transcend the trials and tribulations of pain. And that is a big question when it comes to pain. Will we allow it to debilitate us, or will we allow it to see it as a catalyst for growth and strength? And of course, as we mentioned before, there's a time for everything. King Solomon in his great wisdom said, there's a time for anything. When a person has just experienced a terrible, debilitating blow, you don't sit down with them and say, oh, let me show you how this can lead to growth. Obviously not. The first response is always silence. Like you mentioned, when you go to a mourner's house, you're not allowed to start talking. You have to wait for him to start talking, for her to start talking. You're not allowed to open conversation. Simply out of sensitivity. To be silent. You're telling the person, I'm here for you. Whatever it is you want to do, you want to sit for the next hour and stare at me, that's also fine. Well, you don't have to say anything. Right? And that's what happened when the friends came to visit Job. It says they sat on the floor with him for 7 days. They didn't utter one word. He said, we're here for you. All you need is us to be here, and that'll make you feel good. That's fine as well. And then when the time is right, we take tears and we change them into growth. There's a song. Isn't there a Simon and Garfunkel song about that? For everything there is a season?
That's from the Bible. That's Bob Dylan.
It's Bob Dylan, is that what it is?
For everything, turn. There's a season for everything.
Right. There's a season for everything. So, of course, these are all grand ideas, but every grand idea needs to be implemented in its proper time. Right? Way after a person has gone through a debilitating loss, silence is wrong. As soon as a person has gone through a debilitating loss, trying to convince them how to grow is also wrong. But both ideas in their proper time are practical. So here are some practical suggestions. First and foremost, you have to remember that God is with us even during times of pain, things we discussed tonight. Pain ultimately subsides. It's always acute in the beginning, but over time, again, we don't forget. We always remember when we go through difficult periods, but it subsides. And the best answer to pain ultimately is action, because there's so much good to be done. Faith and trust that life can lead you to a higher plane. And friends. See, none of this can be done alone. It's critical when a person goes through difficult periods to rely on those around him or her. Let's look at text 11a. Whose turn?
It says, one part known with the inner of his own soul. Now it is obvious that one part has this knowledge. So what is the message of this verse? This verse comes to tell you that at times it is inappropriate to share your pain with others. Rather, you should hold it in your heart. For example, if you know that your visitors don't truly care about your pain, then you should only tell someone who shares in your pain. Regarding this, it says, when there's worry in my heart, you should speak it over to the others. But how do you know that they care?
Well, obviously, people know. I mean, if a stranger walks into your house, somebody who you know peripherally, and you start unloading on them, what's the point? For someone that's close to you, or a close relative, or a friend, we all know who can, you know, who's willing to help. So what he's saying is that, you know, practically we have to deal, we're not meant, we weren't created alone, we were created with other people, and it's appropriate to have other people who can help, help. And you have to reach out to them. Just like when you see someone in pain, you should reach out to them. When you're in pain, it's okay to reach out to others as well. And then we have as well two interesting ideas that are also important. We're going to see this in text 11b.
Actually, that's what
you just read. 11a or b?
Let's skip A.
Oh, I skipped A.
Right, okay. So that's basically, so these two ideas. And then you have, when a person's in pain, movement, right? In other words, you have to have positive distractions. You shouldn't dwell on it. Again, after a certain period of time. Helping others is very therapeutic. When a person's in pain, and they help other people with their pain, that is a very therapeutic way to get over it. I mean, I have a personal experience with a good friend of ours, if you know my, the Moyel. He was the Moyel for both Mendel and Shneur Zalman, the rabbi who did to circumcise him. Now he, a very very sad story. He lives in the city. He's a really nice guy. His name is Nachman Kreiman. Huh? He lives in the Hancock Park area. Very special person. Just a very nice guy. And he him and his wife, they had several healthy children, but they had like three children who died within months of being born, and the doctors couldn't figure it out. There was some kind of genetic disease, obviously, but something they couldn't, you know, so many different types, they just didn't know what it was. So they lost three children, you know, 9 months, 6 months, whatever, and it's a very difficult thing to overcome. And his wife particularly took it very hard, and it took her approximately 10 years to get over it. But she just recently, about a year ago, got over it. And she actually was my Mushka's principal. She teaches in the school. And friends were saying she just got over it and she was starting to, you know, be a happy person again, positive. She was really a very good educator. She did a great job in the school, took care of the kids, professionalism. And she had they had a 22-year-old son, right? One of the three healthy children. Great kid, very learned, everything. He got engaged approximately 6 months ago. Got engaged, was going to be married. This is, you know, they're finally seeing the fruits of their labor. And then one day, this was in November when I was in New York, he goes scuba diving, Redondo Beach, freak accident, dies. It was in the news, yeah. Just a crazy story.
You're like Joe. I mean, this is
he went down, he was getting his instructor's license. This was his last dive. He wasn't an inexperienced diver. He knew what he was doing. This was his last dive to get his instructor's license. He was going to be a diving instructor. He was going to get certified. Just a freak accident in 15 feet of water, he drowned. 15 feet. 15 to 18 feet. Which is, it shouldn't happen. These things don't happen.
You just float up and get them there.
So, she, as you can imagine, this was it. She was devastated. She hasn't gone back to work, and they don't expect her to come back. But I just recently heard what she's doing is, she took it upon herself to travel and simply be there with other parents in similar situations that have lost their children in a similar situation, just to comfort them. And I'm assuming the reason why she's doing that is because she realized that the only way I'm ever going to have a chance of somehow recuperating is by helping other people. So helping others, in essence, is very therapeutic. It helps you when you help others. And then channeling grief, pain, and suffering, these are they create enormous energy. And they can either break a person's spirit. Right, a human being's spirit is a very powerful thing, and pain and suffering can break it. That means that must also be an incredible energy, or we can channel it for positive ends. The same grief and suffering can ultimately be transformed into positive ends. So in conclusion, we end tonight that pain and suffering is part of life. We cannot explain it. Silence, right? God tells us there's no way to explain it. But we do not accept it either. Pain and suffering and ultimately is a sign that when we see pain and suffering, we have pain because we realize that something is wrong. This is not appropriate, right? So that's why we do not accept it. But at the same time, we do not become depressed. And the idea is to try to introduce a new perspective, to recognize that good can come even from adverse situations. And how do we deal? How do we move forward? First of all, you share your anxiety with family and friends. You get involved in positive projects. You introduce God into your life. You realize that pain is part of life. It's part of your greater mission. And your soul defines you, not your physical being and pain associated with this. You realize that there's something far beyond just this dimension of life. And you gain strength. You grow as a result of the painful experience. And ultimately, we pray and hope with the ultimate Jewish idea of a time of Mashiach, where there will be no more pain and suffering. As it says in the book of Isaiah, Umocha Hashem Dimo Mikol Odom, that God will wipe away the tears from all our eyes. Key points. First, pain is our first signal that something is wrong, and it is the first step on the road to healing. Pain comes from a place deeper than logic, and as such defies human rationalization. While we cannot explain away pain, we must not resign ourselves to suffering, we must battle it with action. We are more than the sum of our pain, and we can therefore find and resolve to live and to grow despite our losses. Number five, belief in the presence of God in one's life and the primacy. Primacy. Is that primacy or primacy?
Either one. Depends if you're British.
You how do you primacy. Say that?
If you're British, primacy? You say primacy.
I've heard people say primacy.
If you're British.
Yeah. The primacy of the soul, as well as the conviction that nothing is random, are ideas that can provide us with strength to continue in the face of profound suffering. Difficult circumstances often push us to reveal new resources and to more deeply appreciate our true priorities in life. Seven, the support of friends and the dedication to a meaningful project can be powerful tools to promote healing. That is tonight. I want to remind everybody that a week from this Sunday, March 20th at 3 o'clock p.m., we're going to have a grand Purim party in Morocco. And everybody should join us. As you know, our Purim party is always a lot of fun. We have good food, live music, a lot of l'chaims, and good people. So make sure to mark your calendars. Be here or be square.
A week from this coming Sunday.